Call the next case, please.
May it please the court, I'm Frank Friedman representing Norfolk Southern Railway Company. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case involves the removal of a private railroad crossing and the circuit court's ruling that the crossing must be restored and returned to service. And when I say a crossing, I don't mean a full cross arm with flashing lights and a barrier. It's simply a paved area that crosses the tracks and leads across them to an unpaved road and field. For a visual of the crossing prior to its removal, there are photos at JA 539 and 540. Our appeal raises a series of assignments that can be broken down into three basic categories. First, the appeal does raise a question of first impression regarding Rule 322E and whether that rule requires a trial judge presiding over both jury and non-jury issues to sequence events so that the jury issues are heard first. We think the rule does impose that requirement, but here the court did the exact opposite. Hearing the injunction issue first and then dispensing with the jury trial altogether.
Well, counsel, what disputed factors were there in this case that applied to both the legal and equitable claims?
Well, there were two. Basically, the defenses that Norfolk Southern had to both claims were that Breeden had no injury and that Breeden committed the first material breach in any event. These were defenses to both Breeden's legal and equitable claims, and the Norfolk Southern was entitled to have a jury decide those issues. In fact, the court already set a trial date with the jury. That's at JA.
Well, but Breeden, with regard to the first material breach, Breeden was not an original party to the crossing agreement, right?
Breeden was not an original
party. So was a successor in interest.
Correct.
And there's no dispute that it could properly use that crossing.
That Breeden could, yes,
right.
For his sole use and interest, for his own interest and own benefit. What he couldn't do was keep that. See, that's the thing, and that's the intent about this kind of crossing, is that it's intended to limit crossing. There's no guard. You don't want the whole world crossing it. And so what it does, it's a JA-12. It says, you know, it's for the landowners, it says party of the first part, the landowners, own use and own benefit. And what they're arguing is, I can keep my right, and I can let my tenants have it, and I can spread it around. In fact, if you read their brief, I think they would say if they wanted to have a rock concert on that field and they issued licenses to everyone that came through, they can pass it on if they built an apartment complex.
No, that's a completely different question, I think. There's no question this is a covenant running with the land, right?
It is a covenant running with the land per the ruling that is the law of this case.
Right, and he was in fact an assignee.
That is true.
Okay, so then he made his successor an interest in assignee.
He didn't really make his successor an interest. He had his cake and he kept it. He didn't give...
Well, were there any restrictions at all?
Any restrictions?
In the deed?
No, he gave... Well, yes, it says his own interest, his own interest and his own benefit. Now, that doesn't mean you can take it and spread it to everybody else you know.
But didn't the trial court make that determination in the prior lawsuit?
Actually, at page 37, that's a very important point. He specifically said he didn't. He said, we didn't deal with first material breach last time.
But he made, no, not first material breach, but he made the determination that Ditton was a successor to Breeden.
He said he was a successor. That he did say that.
But and so if he was a successor, how could they then breach the contract by his use?
By breaking it down, again, by breaking it down so that multiple parties, if he put in an apartment complex, I hate to think how many people would be using that property. And we don't think that's what's contemplated. Now, the point
right,
is...
Right, but he clearly says on that page that Justice Powell just referenced, in Old Dominion, the court found that successors in title included lessees. And then he later, in the next paragraph, says, the court found that Ditton, the injured party, was a successor in interest under the terms of the crossing agreement.
There's a different question between whether someone is a successor and whether someone who has the power and ability to keep something for their sole benefit can keep it and also spread it out to people using it not for their sole.
Well, how are those people not successors in interest?
We think he could have kept it. He could have kept the interest and let them be tenants without the right to do that. We think he could have sold it to them and they would have become successors. What we don't think he could do, and I think the judge, you know, the judge said first.
What real property concept supports that?
I'm sorry?
What real property case do you have that supports that those three examples you gave are different property interests?
Well, what I'm getting at is that the judge himself said first material breach wasn't decided below. I mean, we filed a demur, page 37. He says that wasn't decided below. And there was evidence that would have come out in these legal... That's why he denied the demur. He didn't grant a demur. He didn't grant anything on it. This issue was just swept under the rug, which is our complaint. So is the no damages. And you know, we're focusing on the first material breach, but I don't want to make that the entire issue. No damages. Their rents went up. They only used this for residential purposes. Their rents went up after this happened. Judge wouldn't let that evidence in. Judge wouldn't let in the fact that they had an adequate remedy at law. Seven, they put on evidence.
But counsel,
what is...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Is any of that relevant to this case because the court had already found that this was a covenant that ran with the land? So are damages or irreparable harm, or is any of that evidence relevant to this case?
I'll step back and take it from another direction, perhaps. Even if it were a restrictive covenant, and it's not. It's not a restrictive covenant.
No, a covenant that runs with the land.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Even if it were a restrictive covenant, under Peril versus Brannon, where you have a retaining wall, and maybe it's not exactly where it should be, but if you take it away, the land collapses. You know, there are plenty of cases that say if you want, an injunction, you need the traditional prerequisites, irreparable harm, lack of an adequate remedy. Even if you have a restrictive covenant, and there are restrictive covenant cases that say we don't need to worry about that, you still balance some equities. What if there were 60 tracts here? In 1940, there was one. Now there's three.
Okay, but again, balancing the equities. Norfolk Southern was fully aware that it had a duty to maintain the crossing under the agreement, right? That was plain.
That is plain.
So why would equities need to be balanced?
Well, because there are equities involved in this case. I mean, we never got there because we were entitled to have a jury first, and so they made the decision... We're not going to show up and put on the equities there, but even to the extent that we tried to put on the equities, the judge said, no, irrelevant, irrelevant, irrelevant. And that's how, you know, they tried to have their cake and eat it too. And the question is,
you have to have disputed facts to have a jury.
We do have disputed facts, though. We have that they have an adequate remedy at law, which is a complete defense. I mean, they put on evidence. They brought in an expert. It's their expert. It's their appraiser. $7,500 would fix this. And, you know, if their appraiser had come in and said, gee, $200,000 is what you're entitled to, they wouldn't have made this motion to shortchange the jury. But instead, when they got $7,500, they said, Judge, let's just skip that. And Rule 322 doesn't leave anything to the imagination. I mean, it is pretty clear. It says, in any case, when there are both jury and non-jury issues to be tried, and there were, the court shall adopt trial procedures and a sequence of proceedings to assure that all issues properly heard by the jury are decided by it. And applicable factual determinations by the jury shall be used by the judge in resolving the non-jury issues in this case. Shall. Okay? They did not do that. They did not do that here, and there were defenses that we had that were, we think, strong.
I'll be clear. There are two issues you say were jury issues that were in both the equitable and the legal claim, and that's first breach and whether they were damaged or the amount of damage.
Well, we both. I mean, our argument was you only use this for residential purposes. And I might add, we argued this, even trying to do cross at this hearing, but just without witnesses. All you used this for was residential purposes. And what happened? Your rents went up. Okay? So you didn't really lose anything. And yet you come in and you say, well, we could be whole for $7,500. We offered to pay $7,500 in court. The point is that there was, in this case, if you do look at the balance of the equities, they have a de minimis injury. Their expert came in and said $7,500.
I understand why first breach is well, you claim it's a jury issue that would permeate both claims. But with damages, the damage question between the legal claim and the equitable claim, were, yes, they've got to be damaged, but how you look at that is different sometimes between asking for an injunction and asking for money damages. So would you have a jury then answer an interrogatory that says, were they damaged?
I think a fair one would be, were they damaged, and if so, in what amount?
But that doesn't answer...
were they damaged is a defense that we...
But that's not something you would ask in an injunctive relief. Were they damaged and how much?
Well,
you would ask, were they damaged and do they have an adequate remedy of law? And if they don't, is it irreparable?
Correct.
It's a different analysis and question when it comes to damage between the two.
But even, you know, and I'm running out of time, so I'll close with this. Even if you want to suggest that we don't follow Rule 322E, and we think here the court just completely ignored it, did the opposite. In Landrum versus Chippenham Hospitals, this court said that to ignore relevant factors is an abuse of discretion. And if it's not relevant that there's already been an accident, that this is a danger to the public, that there's already been one wreck, that their position is we can give it to anybody and more people can come in, that in 1940 there was one track and now there are three tracks and who knows how many there'll be in the future, you know, the judge was just like, we're going to cut this short after 1.5 witnesses. We're not going to let you even cross-examine any more people, and it's over. And we think in leaving out all the evidence that's effective for the balance of the equities, you know, this is worse than just not considering those things.
Why doesn't Spilling versus Hutchinson and its progeny address the issue of whether you get to put on any issue of damages? That case says the injunction is granted almost as a matter of course upon a breach of the covenant. The amount of the damages and even the fact that the plaintiff has sustained any pecuniary damages are wholly immaterial. The moment that the court finds that there has been a breach of the covenant, that is an injury. Why doesn't that case stand for the proposition that it's irrelevant whether the amount of the damages or whether they were irreparably harmed?
It's different because this court says it's different. Wren, 181 Virginia 360, says that it's different when you have a restrictive covenant. Northrop Treatise, which is cited there and in other places, says restrictive covenants are different. Contracts are between parties. Restrictive covenants affect other people in the world. You're not allowed to have a three-story building in the whole subdivision. That affects other people. This is a contract between individual people, and they have remedies, and they've conceded what their remedy is. And I think we'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Terry Lynn, the attorney for E.A. Breeden, the appellee in this case. This case is about the authority a trial court has to protect a person's real property interest by granting an injunction. It's E.A. Breeden's position that as the Rockingham County Circuit Court followed lots of Virginia Supreme Court precedent, we would ask that you affirm the granting of the injunction, which protected E.A. Breeden's right-of-way across the railroad tracks and allowed it to have access to Route 340. The case is also about protecting clients and parties from having to defend against unsupported defenses. And in that regard, if we're a cross error, we are asking the court to reverse the trial court's denial of attorney fees in the amount of $18,500 to Breeden for having to prepare for the injunction hearing when there were no relevant disputed facts to oppose the motion for summary judgment. The case starts with a 1940 crossing agreement, which has previously been discussed by Norfolk Southern. Within that crossing agreement, Norfolk Southern actually got the Yanceys to give up two crossings in exchange for them building one crossing. The Yanceys owned property on both sides of the track at the time the crossing agreement was entered into, but through a series of transactions, the property was sold to various other people who became successors in interest. The crossing agreement was recorded in the Rockingham County Circuit Court and became part of the chain of title. In 1996, E.A. Breeden purchased approximately 2.5 acres of land, and they became a successor in interest to the crossing agreement. Breeden rented that property, and based upon the law of an underlying case...
Excuse me, let me just, while you're on the facts, I take it that by dividing the tract, this 2.5 acres was carved out, and the railroad right-of-way does not touch it. It's on the lands of others, but a right-of-way previously existed from it across the lands of others to the 2.5 acres. Is that right?
That's correct. There was a 9-foot access easement which provided a right-of-way from Route 622 to Route 340. And that was part of the deed that was to E.A. Breeden.
So the railroad's right-of-way has never been a part of this land, the 2.5 acres. That's always been removed from where the railroad right-of-way is located, correct?
The 2.5 acres was part of the property the Yanceys owned when the crossing agreement was entered into.
I understand, yeah.
And the crossing agreement allowed for access from that property across the tract. And in the deed to E.A. Breeden, there was the right-of-way from their property across the tract to Route 340.
Does the lease to Breeden, excuse me, the lease from Breeden to the tenant contain any language concerning the use of the crossing?
Concerning the crossing agreement, no, Your Honor. There's nothing in the lease, in any of the lease agreements with regard to the crossing agreement. Based on the Old Dominion case, in the underlying, this case has a long history, but what happened briefly is that one of Breeden's tenants sued the railroad for personal injury sustained as a result of the railroad's failure to maintain the crossing. The railroad settled that case and then turned around and sued E.A. Breeden for indemnification under the terms of the crossing agreement. In ruling on that case, we filed a motion for summary judgment on behalf of EA Breeden. And in ruling on that case, the court had to decide whether whether their use of the crossing could be imputed to EA Breeden to make EA Breeden responsible for indemnification under the terms of the crossing agreement. So in making that decision, we filed a motion for summary judgment. The court granted the motion for summary judgment, and in doing so found a number of things. One was with regard to Ditton. Based on the Old Dominion case, the court found that Ditton was a successor in interest to the crossing agreement because he held a lesser interest in the property himself by virtue of his lease. And so he had his own individual right to use the crossing, and that use could not be imputed to Breeden. So that was one of the things the court found, was that Ditton was a successor in interest, had his own right to use the crossing. The second thing the court found was that it was a covenant running with the land, that is the crossing agreement. It was a covenant running with the land, that it touched and concerned E.A. Breeden's property. And the third thing that the court found was that Norfolk Southern had the sole duty to maintain that crossing. So those were the court's prior rulings from the indemnification count. So knowing that the court had issued those rulings and that the railroad had the duty to maintain the crossing and that concerned Breeden's land, the railroad then removes the crossing. And so E.A. Breeden at that point in time filed the injunction action to get the crossing put back in place. So we go to court, and armed with the fact that the court has really already interpreted this crossing agreement and made certain rulings, that's when E.A. Breeden filed a motion for summary judgment, asking that the court, based on its prior rulings, issue the injunction. It was their position that based on the spilling decision, Sonoma Development, that all the court had to do was to find that there was a breach of the covenant, and then it could issue the injunction.
Counsel, I'm sorry. I want to get to one of the specific assignments of error,
okay,
and your response to it. Assignment of error number 1B,
okay,
it relates solely to the trial court's action violated our Rule 3.22E.
Okay.
So I just want to focus on that subpart of Assignment of Error 1.
Okay.
In your brief, your response to that Assignment of Error is a single paragraph on page top of page 11. That says, no, it does not violate Rule 322E because the railway did not file a plea in equity.
That's
and there's no case citation for that, but I understand your position. When I go to Rule 322E, and do you have a copy of 322E in front of you somewhere?
I don't, Your Honor, but I'm pretty sure I know what you're
okay.
talking about. Well, actually, I do. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I do.
It's entitled Trial by Mixed Jury and Non-Jury Claims. And within 3:22E, there is no reference to the requirement for a plea in equity. So I then tried to parse the entire rule. And the entire rule consists of five subparts of equal dignity. So in other words, 3:22A appears to be read independently of B, or of C, or of D, or of E. E does not depend upon anything that came before it, as it is worded. Where do you find, or what is your argument about why a plea in equity is an absolute predicate to the application of 322E?
Well, first of all, and I'm going to sort of back up a little bit, but the answer that was filed by Norfolk Southern whereas it had a number of grounds of defense, it did not request a jury trial. So that's the first issue we have here. Second of all, I don't know that I would ever have read 3:22 just in isolation, because Section C clearly addresses the right to a jury in certain equitable claims. Rule 3:22.
Okay.
And so I would not have just isolated one section of that statute without looking at subsection C, which specifically addresses an equitable claim, which is what my injunction hearing was. And that section clearly says that in an equitable claim where no right to jury trial otherwise exists, where impaneling of an advisory jury pursuant to Code Section 8.01.36E to hear an issue will be helpful to the court concerning disputed fact issues, such a jury may be seated. Such decision on such claims and issues shall be made by the judge. Also, all the cases...
Okay, so your position is that we cannot get to, or the trial judge could not apply E without first going through the portal of C1. That C1 had to be complied with before you can ever reach E.
Yes.
Okay.
And I believe that the Wright decision that's cited in my brief also addresses, and it's not a simple matter of just filing an answer and grounds of defense. It's an actual special pleading that you have to file in order to have an advisory panel on an equitable claim. And the cases I've read with regard to that issue, it is discretionary to the judge. And, you know, the Rockingham Circuit Court judge felt that he was clearly prepared to rule on the injunction issue based upon the facts and the evidence that was before him. I mean, that's the comment he made from the bench, that he had enough issue. He also told...
There's no question that he had enough information to rule. I think the question is that a trial by jury, there is a constitutional right. And although it doesn't apply in equity, and I think 3:22E is attempting to balance how we deal with your common law equity rights vis-a-vis your constitutional jury right. And I just, but you've answered my question, so I appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you.
I believe that the Old Dominion case, the Spilling case, the Benoit case, they all support what the Rockingham County Circuit Court did in granting this injunction. And that is, once the court found that there had been a breach of the covenant running with the land, they then realized that damages were irrelevant, inconvenience was irrelevant. There was a contract in place, and by granting the injunction, they were just requiring the parties to do exactly what they had agreed to do. And that's the principle that was just followed in each one of those cases involving a real property interest. As for the cross error, it's their position that when Norfolk Southern presented to the court at the time of the motion for summary judgment that there were disputed issues of fact, that was unsubstantiated because they showed up less than 30 days later at the injunction hearing with not one single witness to place any contested issue before the court. And so in order to prepare for that injunction hearing, we had 6 witnesses there, spent an inordinate amount of time to prepare the witnesses to address latches and acquiescence and the date of the removal of the crossing, which is what they were claiming was in dispute, when actually none of those issues were actually contested at the time of the injunction hearing. And we believe that them standing up at the time of the motion for summary judgment and claiming that those were contested issues, yet not even contacting E.A. Breeden's counsel to tell them we're not bringing any witnesses to contest any of this at the time of the injunction hearing was oppressive and justified E.A. Breeden being reimbursed the amount of money that was spent in having to prepare for that hearing. And so we ask that the court affirm the trial court's ruling with regard to the injunction and reverse the trial court's ruling with regard to the request for attorney's fees. Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, would you address that Rule 322 issue briefly?
I would be happy to. This wasn't just an equitable claim. This was a mixed claim. They have a claim that was never withdrawn for $500,000 at JA5. This was a mixed claim. And you know, the Rule 322 couldn't be any clearer that when you have mixed claims, if you have defenses that are common to both, and they could have withdrawn the $500,000 request, but they wanted a safety valve. And that's what they're not allowed to have. If you have both, then for constitutional reasons, with the merger of law and equity, law goes first. You get your jury trial. I would be happy to answer other questions. I know my time is up.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Court is adjourned.
All rise.